Right. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this event organised by the Dahrendorf Forum, part of LSE Ideas, and the European Institute. I think there's a hashtag somewhere, is it? LSE Brexit? Or LSE Europe? Anyway, you'll see it on the screen there. We're delighted to welcome Paolo Gentiloni. I guess you all know who he is. I don't really need to introduce him, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But just to remind you of some of the things he's done, he's been a member of the Italian Parliament now for over 18 years. He was a minister under the Prodi government for communication, so this is a very apposite that he's communicating with us. Foreign minister under the Renzi government, and then he became prime minister when Renzi had this little local difficulty with his constitutional referendum. And he was served as prime minister for 18 months, which I think is above the average for Italian prime ministers.
That's true.
So you may not be a record breaker, but you're doing very well. You still have some way to catch up with Silvio. So you're going to talk to us for 25, 30 minutes on your reflections on the future of Europe. But if you care to stray into Italian politics, that's up to you.
Yeah.
And then we'll have some questions from me, followed by questions from the hall. So without further ado, Signor Gentiloni, per favore.
Grazie.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, it's true. It's two things from your introduction. One, we have frequent changes of government in my country, but we have also rather stable fundamental of policies in the last 50, 60 years. Perhaps we are now living a rather different moment, and it will be interesting to discuss this with you. And secondly, you are right, we have problems with referendum, not only in Italy, but it is... I remember when I met the president of Colombia, he won the Nobel Prize, he reached peace in his country. And then, leaving me, he told me, beware with the referendum, because he won the Nobel Prize, but the agreement that he reached in his country was defeated in the referendum. So, thank you for your introduction and for this reference to our referendum. Well, 3 years have now passed since that dawn of June 24. When we were surprised, because we were not expecting, by the majority of the British citizens who voted to leave the European Union. That vote was not a catastrophic but isolated accident. It was rather the peak of the perfect storm that has affected the European Union. Since that moment, we have been through times of enthusiasm and downfalls. The path out chosen by the British people has proved to be a resounding failure from my point of view. And a dangerous uncertainty still looms in this country. This is what I understand also for the next days. In the last 3 or 4 years, the Eurozone economies experienced a period of growth followed by a recent slowdown. The nationalist and populist wave was successful in my country, but it was defeated in France and halted in other nations. One thing is certain, in any case, the dangers that have appeared during that perfect storm are not behind us. In the next European elections, many national issues will play a role, as it always happens, but the stakes will be incredibly high. The future of the European Union itself. From the abyss of the 20th century, a story of success rose, the European Union. The first to benefit from this success story have been the baby boomers, my generation, which has lived without wars and blessed by an improvement of individual well-being, that seemed unstoppable. The founding fathers of the Union instead lived through war, almost without interruption since 1914, for 40 long years. The European idea, therefore, was born above all to prevent war, a goal that we always have to keep in mind. As Helmut Kohl reminded us many years ago, when speaking to the French National Assembly, he said, and quoting, "I doubt that the evil spirits of the past under which we in Europe have already suffered more than enough this century have been banished forever. Every generation will shoulder the task of preventing their return." Peace and well-being with a common market, which in a few decades has become the greatest commercial power in the world, and with the European social model, which in its different forms, social democratic or Christian democratic, Scandinavian or British, Mediterranean or continental, is founded on the universality of some essential social service. The welfare state, a European uniqueness in the world. And finally, shoulder to shoulder with the great American democracy, the proud defense of the primacy of freedom, of individual rights, of the rule of law, of freedom of expression, of minorities. A Europe made of values, so strong to attract, in first place, the countries of the South, still dominated by fascist dictatorships, Greece, Spain, and Portugal, and then the nations of the East, finally free from the communist yoke. A European Union that offered the ideal conditions to fulfill the German reunification. In the new century, dear friends, everything changed. The European project ended up being a victim of its own accomplishments, almost as it was a luxury that we could afford only during that decade of unbridled optimism, between 11/9/1989 and 9/11/2001. Faded the great illusion of the late 20th century, and lacking the strong political cohesion of the Cold War, the European Union was surprised by the impetuous return of history, a return that has casted as main characters the national states, not the Union. At his historical juncture, the project of the founding fathers seems to have lost his propelling force. Europe will not be made all at once or according to a single plan. It will be built through concrete achievements which first create a de facto solidarity. With these words, Robert Schuman described the European vision in his famous 1950 speech. For decades, this vision was pursued with Jean Monnet's functionalist approach of a realistic, gradual path that, in the end, even many staunch federalists began to appreciate. But that idea was suited for the happy season of peace building and of unstoppable economic growth. The functionalist approach, despite Schengen and the common currency, has proved to be too thin for a time of crisis, of death in our sea, of nationalist resurgences. The great crisis that struck 10 years ago has turned upside down the point of view of Western citizens' masses on globalization. Globalization is not a feast, or to be fair, it has been just for the elites and maybe for Asia's and Latin America's middle class. Certainly not for the most fragile segment of the American and European middle class. Surely the gap in terms of GDP per capita is still huge. The GDP of the Eurozone is five times higher than China's per capita GDP. But in large chunks of the European populations, it is not GDP that is declining. It is optimism about the future. And at the dawn of the never-ending growth myth, a new fear is conquering the stage. Globalization is not only unable to guarantee economic wealth, but it threatens our identities challenged by migration. And what better direction to defend these identities to turn backwards? This is the ground in which a new political offer is flourishing, national populism. Nothing comparable with the 20th century left or right. Rather, these tendencies should remind us those European sleepwalkers who, at the end of the Belle Epoque, beginning of the last century, were unable to see or were unwilling to stop the tide that provoked the Great War, which ended exactly one century ago. Take back control. This was Brexit's winning slogan. Let's take back control of our country. The target is not this or that European rule, which often the larger public ignores. The target is the Union itself. And it is not only the Britons who are knocking down the European constructs. Walls at the borders are coming back. Countries experiencing economic hardships blame Brussels or Berlin. In the north, stereotypes regarding hedonists and wasteful southern Europeans are surfacing again, up to the extreme paradox embodied by the current Italian government, which in the name of hostility towards Brussels ends up supporting countries and parties that oppose every common responsibility on migration policies and that sometimes denigrates Italy. So, dear friends, in less than 10 years, the wind has changed and the United States are blowing in the wrong direction. It's not the first time that the American administration looks at the European Union with diffidence. But Donald Trump's tone are unprecedented. The Europeans are seen as competitors, sometimes even in similar ways as the Russians and the Chinese. America first is indeed another way to say take back control. In 1989, backwards, it has been defined. And we are living it right now, when the 30th anniversary of that magnificent hurricane of freedom is approaching, November this year. Defending the European Union now, it is not something just for Brussels' key supporters. Multilateralism, free commerce, environmental sustainability, welfare, and freedom are at stake. The challenge is to prove that democracy and freedom are more efficient and beneficial to the majority of citizens than any alternative, and that the geopolitical tensions surrounding us still require the presence of a quiet superpower like the European Union. Maintaining the status quo together in 27 countries, hoping to deliver small advancements, it is now a strategy without a future. The only possible result, proceeding in that way, is to let every important decision to the European Council, where every single government can assert its own interest, too often at the expense of the common interest. The Commission is chained by this contradiction. Just remember last year, the stark contrast between the ambition of Jean-Claude Juncker's State of the Union speech and the minimalism of the Commission's White Book which for the future of the EU was just putting on the table five possible and very different scenarios. It was still Jean Monnet who used to warn us, we cannot stop when all around us the whole world is on the move. Well, we have stopped, sadly. Where do we start today to push back nationalist and anti-Europe positions? Immediately showing that we understood at least one lesson. The Union can't ignore the two main issues that dominate the political agenda of its member states: jobs and migration, the priorities of the next 20 years. I'm aware of the importance of cohesion policies, of the single market, of agricultural policy, etc. But it will be increasingly hard to defend a union that proves to be reluctant on the future of jobs, because first we have to keep budgets in order, or that seems absent on resolving the issue of migration flows, leaving first arrival countries to handle by themselves. In Italy, the governments led by the Democratic Party achieved important results. But it was not enough, as the recent, not recent, 1 year ago elections showed. Of course, the return to growth from a minus 2.8 in 2012 up to a plus 1.6 in 2017, surely the deficit reduction from 5.2 to 2.3 of our GDP. Of course, unemployment finally returning again around the 10% threshold. Of course, the drastic reduction of the smuggling of human beings from Libya collapsed by 80% between early 2017 and early 2018. But these results were not enough to stop an unprecedented synergy of illusions and fears. The national populist wave won the Italian elections 1 year ago, describing the European Union as its indispensable external enemy. The current government feels closer to Trump and Putin than to the European Union. In the economic field, the maelstrom of announcements arriving from Italy makes us perceive only one thing: that the narrow path of an economic growth attained lowering the deficit and without increasing the debt has been abandoned. In just 9 months, years of efforts are now at risk. The deficit and the debt are rising. The fundamentals of Italian economy did not change, but we have a slowdown of the Eurozone's economy. We had a dramatic loss of financial reputation. We have a deep crisis in confidence of consumers and entrepreneurs. Our economy is technically in recession. And according to international consensus, our growth rate in this year will be more or less 0.2-0.4%. So low growth with rather high interest rates, if this is the scenario, economy will not help our people and the government of Italy. It is a situation in which Italy finds itself isolated at the sidelines of Europe. I am telling this in Britain, where I think we all perceive how this problem could influence our lives. The challenge that now awaits the Union is first and foremost a political challenge. Making a reference to the debate of the early 50s, we need more a European defense community than a European coal and steel community. That was the community beginning the process of EU. We need more courage to fill the geopolitical vacuum left by the Trump administration choices. We need further progress in the common defense policy. We need to proceed with increased level of integration, not for all 27, that would prove to be impossible, but rather with a core of 15, 20 countries willing to do so, a group which in part, but not in all, coincides with the Eurozone, and leaving, obviously, the door open to every member state. Will we have a Europe with different level of integration in our future? Yes. We have chosen so in the solemn declaration marking the 60 years of our treaties, and in fact, we have been doing so for years. Just think to the common currency or to Schengen. They are not a 27 story, both the common currency and Schengen. We have to move on, and we must move swiftly before there is common European irrelevance, even in Africa and in the Mediterranean, becomes a reality. Before the achievements of the Paris Agreement are compromised. Before the idea of a taxation of web giants, if pursued without any cohesion between European states, turns up to be only a pipe dream. We must move without any fear. And for these reasons, too, in the next round of European elections, we must aim to strengthen the democratic legitimacy of the Union, from its highest institutional level to the role of the Parliament. We don't want to sideline anyone, but the core of the Union has to be more integrated, and it must have a stronger democratic sovereignty. Sovereignists won't like this sovereign Europe. But the only alternative is an impasse which becomes more and more dangerous. So, dear friends, we are patriots and we are wholeheartedly Europeans. I hope that this long-standing position of my country won't change in this defining moment for our common European destiny. The Italy of the national populist government could find itself against our history and against geography itself, and we cannot afford this. The European Union, for which the next EU institution should work, from my point of view, has three distinctive features. It's a more integrated and cohesive European Union, even accepting, I repeat, that this choice may be not shared by all 27 member states. The door needs to be left open for everyone, but we cannot let anyone prevent the reinforced cooperation that our treaties already allow. Second point, an expansionary economic policy and the gradual transition from convergence between the various economies of the Eurozone to a risk-sharing approach in front of unforeseen shocks. This approach can't take form without a decisive German contribution. But a balanced approach is possible. After all, the debt burden accounts for about 85% of the Eurozone GDP. It is a relatively low percentage, comparing it with the current situation of all the other global economic players. The German surplus in current account is the largest in the entire world and is unprecedented in post-World War II history. Some countries, starting with my own, must commit themselves to a gradual debt reduction. And this is what we have done in the last years, and unfortunately we are changing in the last months. Others, such as Germany, or the Netherlands, we have to push the lever of investments and expansive growth in front of recent clear signs of an economic slowdown. This dual effort would give clear benefits to everyone. It will give a great contribution to important European plans for infrastructure, digital innovation, and artificial intelligence to tackle climate change. And it would make the goal of a Eurozone budget more clear and more credible. Finally, on migration policies and on the international role of the EU. We need a common policy, and we have not even a sketch of this common policy. We share a common interest toward the presence in Africa that is more focused on promoting growth than on defending linguistic heritages or geopolitical influences. Final remarks, dear friends, students, ladies and gentlemen. National populism is certainly going to affect also transatlantic relations. First of all, the role of NATO, relation with Moscow. A significant part of national populists constantly boast special relation with Russia. But in reality, national populists are strongly divided. Just think of Salvini, the leader of Lega in Italy, and Kaczynski, the leader of the national populist Poland. In their recent meeting, the clash on relation with Russia was crystal clear. US-EU tensions is perhaps the biggest question mark for the near future. The position of the US administration is well known. It is difficult to predict which trend will prevail in Europe between the free trade views, Germany, the Netherlands, historically Italy, an emerging tone of autarky in certain countries, today's Italy, for example, and the Macron view, which calls for a protectionist commitment at the European level, l'Europe qui protège. In the post-war era, the transatlantic relationship was not just a military alliance or a bulwark of the free market. It was also the main engine to promote liberal democracy. And we should safeguard this principle despite tensions in transatlantic relations, particularly because without this common principle, it will be difficult to identify a shared geopolitical interest between Europe and the United States vis-a-vis China. If it's only a matter of economic interest, it is difficult to have a common view. The hope in a more human globalization stands in the same place in which the greatest delusion dwells, Europe. The European economic giant has not enough weight in geopolitical terms, and it struggles to answer the main demands of its citizens with common policies on jobs and migration. But it is still an amazing force of cultural attraction in an age that requires a new humanism. And Europe still has the unicity of its welfare and its courage that we have seen in its highest form when the Bataclan in Paris reopened. Europe still has its strong desire for freedom, a desire that Berlin embodies better than every other city 30 years after 1989. And its civility, of which a little Sicilian island, Lampedusa, has become a symbol. Even Brexit in the last 2 years was a sort of demonstration of EU resilience. Leaving the Union has proved to be a very bad business. Brexit became a sort of warning for Eurosceptics all over Europe and in Italy also. I firmly believe that we still have a chance to avoid a catastrophic no deal, either with some sort of cosmetic update of the agreement and a short delay, or with a more strategic decision to call a second referendum. In any case, Brexit's destiny is not in EU hands. It depends on the decision that the British Parliament will take. I fondly remember the words that Pope Francis addressed to the leader gathered in Rome for the 60th anniversary of the treaties. As leaders, you are called to blaze the path of a new European humanism made up of ideals and concrete actions, a new European humanism. European elections of the next 26th of May will be the moment of truth in the challenge against national populism. We will not win this challenge defending the current state of the Union, but aiming to change it, keeping open the perspective of the United States of Europe. It will be a decisive choice. On one side, those who want to give sovereignty back to the little fatherlands, undermining the very foundations of the European building and its many achievements: peace, welfare state, freedom. At the opposite side, those who want to change the Union, giving more strength and legitimacy to the common policies on defense, migration, jobs, common goods, environment, education. Between the Europe of the sleepwalkers and the Europe of the democrats, everyone must choose a side. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. It's reassuring to hear a voice of optimism towards the end of your speech, because we are rather short of optimism in this country at the moment. What I propose to do, as I said earlier, is to ask a couple of questions from me, then open it to the audience. At the end of the session, and we have to be very prompt at 10 to 2, I would ask people to remain seated so that we can leave quickly. And there's also a security element to this. So I would ask your indulgence in this. Now, let me start with what might seem like a provocative question to you. The Italian economy over the last 20 years has managed an average growth rate of precisely zero, an annual average growth rate of zero. Youth unemployment is at dramatically high levels, and that is despite the diaspora of Italians to other countries. Is this sustainable? Can a country endure this kind of stagnation without rupturing?
I think we have a problem, for sure. It is long and complicated to analyze the reasons of this stagnation. Stagnation is, as always, an average of periods of relative growth, and the strongest with Greece and Spain, shock of decrease and economic crisis that a European country lived 10 years ago, 8 years ago, in between 2009 and 2011-2012. So we had this average, the zero average, unfortunately, is an average of period of relative growth, period of stark descent, very strong crisis, perhaps the strongest crisis with the other two countries I mentioned, and then a gradual period of regaining growth in the last 4 years. We have two problems. One is that this new period of regaining growth is apparently finished, and this is from my point of view, because of two things. One is the government we have, and second is the context of the Eurozone, and particularly is the slowdown of German economy. We are very much intertwined with Germany. Our economy and German economy are very strongly intertwined. So this is my first, the first issue is, okay, we are regaining, we were regaining growth, but this has finished more or less 6-8 months ago. New government, slowdown of Germany. Percentage, you can decide. I think 60-40. The new government would say 0-100. It's all German fault. It's not exactly so, because our problems began even before the German slowdown, in recent May and June. But we do have also long-term problems, not only problems of short-term. I would, if you ask me, what is the main long-term problem that we have in Italy, I would answer, we have several problems, as all countries have. The single main problem we have is that in the last maybe 50 years, we never succeeded to really and seriously reduce the differences that we have in our countries between the, so to say, center-north part of the country, especially the north and center-east part of the country, and the southern part of the country. Because if you look to the central north part of Italy, and especially to some region of the north and center east part of Italy, we are talking of one of the richest and fastest growing area of Europe. Richest and fastest growing. With enormous problem of finding jobs. Not that you don't find jobs, that you have...
find staff.
You are looking for staff, and you have problems in finding staff. If you are an engineer in a university in Lombardia or Emilia-Romagna, you are followed by companies when you begin your course in university, and they are waiting for your graduate to pick you because they have not sufficient engineers. Other parts of the countries are in a still, and we, this is perhaps the strongest failure of our governments in the last decades. We were not able not only to cancel but to reduce this distance. It is not only an Italian problem. We know that we have similar problems in Germany, in UK, but the dimension of the problem in Italy is stronger than in other countries. It is not the only reason, but it is one, for sure, from my point of view, if you ask me one reason, this is one reason. We were not able to reduce these distances. And you have in the same country one of the richest part of Europe and of the world, and a much more difficult situation in other regions. And we are the same country.
Following on from that, many in Italy would say, rightly or wrongly, fairly or unfairly, Europe is to blame for Italy's difficulties. Do you think there is a reasonable response to that charge?
I think that there is many things that we have to discuss with Europe, and several things that didn't work, as I also said in my remarks about Europe. But blaming Europe is a totally wrong game, because we had, if we look to the long period of the last 60 years from the birth of the European Community, as it was called, generally speaking, a very strong contribution to our growth from Europe, and a very strong Italian contribution to European growth.
It's a very clear answer.
Yes. Then do we have something to quarrel with our European friends and institution? Yes, we have. And I tried to signal a couple of points, but for sure I was provocative in my remarks, but I am profoundly convinced that we don't have a migration policy in Europe. We don't have even a sketch of a migration policy in Europe. It's all fake. We discuss about this Dublin rules, nothing to do with the reality of the migration issue. And then we have this more difficult to discuss, but this, from my point of view, obsession of the debt that prevent EU to have a investment and expansionist economic policy. And this, in time of slowdown of your economy, is a problem. Look, 85% of the debt in ratio with the GDP is nothing with the debt that you see in China, in Japan, in US, in the other big economic player. Nothing. I perfectly understand the reason why certain countries, and I respect profoundly Germany, which is the main one, has the problem of, historical problem of dealing with the debt. You know that in German debt and guilt are the same words.
Short.
Yeah. And I understand this. But you can't have this enormous surplus. It's not only a problem that it is not in the European rules to have such a big surplus. You can't have an enormous surplus and distances from different European countries and not having an expansionary economic policy. So we have many things to change, but beware. The national populist offer is not for changing things in Europe. It is for abandoning the European project. This is reality. I don't accept the idea that we are discussing how will we change Europe. No, the common ground of national populism is take back control. And take back control means only one thing: to abandon the European project. You will take back control in your Italy, in your Bulgaria, in your Greece, in your UK, wherever. You will have no role at international level. You will play any role on the environmental issue, on the peace issue, and so on and so forth. If you want this, take it, but don't say that you accept Europe, but you want only to change Europe. Because you are not wanting to change Europe, you are wanting to destroy the substance of the European project.
Okay, last short question from me about another local difficulty. Natural allies in the campaign that you seem to support for having more risk sharing across Europe would normally be France and Italy. But over the last few months, we've seen a series of disputes between particularly Salvini and Macron. Is this poisoning the natural relationship that could drive Europe forward?
Absolutely.
I told you it was a short question.
I think I deem totally unreasonable the aggressive attitude the Italian government has towards France. Maybe France is using also this in the political dynamic. I understand that maybe France is saying, okay, we have a good adversary also to deal with our internal problems. But the fundamental of this story is coming from the Italian government. I am being very blunt on this. The Italian government took France as an enemy. It is totally unreasonable, not only for historical, we are France, we are cousins. We call ourselves cousins, Italians and French. Nous sommes cousins. Okay, but for contemporary reasons, as you were saying, just think to one thing. There is the seven southern members of the European Union that a couple of years ago a relevant minister of finance called the Club Med of Europe. I mean, Italy, France, Spain, Greece, Portugal, Malta, and Cyprus. These seven countries after Brexit are 52% of EU GDP. So the majority of EU GDP. And also not a majority, but a near majority of the EU population. We had several difficulties in these years to build a common policy of this group of southern countries because of the fact that one of the government of this club, the Spanish one, legitimately had a different point of view. They were a little bit more, to make it simple, pro-German than pro-Mediterranean. Now the Spanish government changed his mind 1 year ago, and it happens that we have an Italian government that is not pro-Mediterranean, but it is pro-Visegrad. It is totally crazy.
Okay, let me now turn to the audience. I'm going to take questions in groups of three. I'd be grateful if you'd wait for the microphone, say who you are, do not make a speech, but ask something very succinct. So who wants to be first? Okay, we have maybe the lady there, the back there to begin with. And then in the middle of the front row, so the next one over here.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm Alessia from the European Institute and from Naples. So since you said that...
Speak straight into the microphone.
Since you said that disparities among regions is not only an Italian problem, but an European one, I would like to ask you which main factors prevented your governments from dealing with the Questione Meridionale in Italy? And especially I would like to ask you if it's only a question of efficiency, because it's more efficient to allocate resources in the north, or if there are structural problems that prevent the south of Italy from coming out from the situation of underdevelopment. Thank you.
Okay, and in the middle of the third row here, the blue shirt.
Enrico here, a student at the LSE. No, actually, my question was related to the previous one. I was wondering also if you would provide some suggestions of what governments or reasonable governments in the future should do about the stark difference between the south and north of Italy. Yes, thank you.
And maybe just here, right in the front row, please.
Thank you, President Gentiloni, for meeting us. My name is Giacomo, and I'm studying political economy at LSE. And I'd like to ask you, this morning I read the news on the Financial Times that Italy is endorsing the One Belt and One Road initiative of the Chinese government. The United States didn't really take this news quite well. And therefore, what I'd like to ask you is, we have the opportunity to gain an important role in Europe after the UK will leave, also given the voting methods in the council and so on and so forth. But this alignment of the Italian government with Putin, with China, and far away from our allies like Macron, like Germany, the European allies and the American ones, where does this lead us with respect to the future of Europe and the future of our nation and our country in Europe? Thank you.
That's a very short question, obviously.
Thank you. Well, the two questions were similar about the South. It is, as you know, because you are Italian, you know it's a very old issue. What I simply believe is that we had an idea growing in the 90s and in the first 10 years of the new century, The idea was because of the failure of special policies towards the southern part of Italy, because we lived a failure in some way. No, not everything worked. Something worked in the 60s. We had good results in the industrialization and infrastructure of the South. But after this, in the 70s, in the 80s, we had a lot of corruption, of failures. We call them cathedral in the desert, you know, in the South, plants without anything around. So the idea that took place at the end of the last century and the beginning of the new century was what kind of policy should we have towards the southern part of Italy? No policy at all. The way to deal with the problem of the South was to deal with the South exactly in the same way as you are dealing with the rest of the country. Because this would create competition, meritocracy, dynamics in industries, and this will put an end to corruption in public aid, in public intervention. There was something correct in this idea, but as it frequently happens, the pendulum is dangerous. Yes, we had failures in special programs for the South, but this, from my point of view, doesn't mean that we don't need special programs for the South. So what I would suggest to a new and a little bit more stable government than mine, even if it was one of the not shortest government in our republic, and this is one of the problems, obviously, is to have a special, so to say, crash program for the South. I introduced, and it was discussed in Italy, again, a ministry for the South. I introduced a couple of relevant measures. Now we have a mandatory percentage of public investment that should be destined to the southern region of Italy. It is mandatory. It is a law. And second, we have special treatment for jobs, and especially for young people, jobs in the South. But this is not a sufficient crash program. So my suggestion is to abandon the idea that only the free market will allow, and the competition will allow, the weakest region of our country to develop. We need a strong public intervention. Yes, we had failures and corruption, but this cannot justify the fact that we leave to the free hand of the market the evolution of the southern part of Italy, because it will not work. There are exceptions, wonderful exceptions, of industries, companies, universities in the South, but as a whole, we need a crash program. On our international position, it is, I think, it is true that even changing frequently governments, Italy has an astonishing coherence in its international position in the last 60 or 70 years. If you look to the main European countries, perhaps Italy with Germany, Germany after 51, 52, 53, is the single relevant European countries with a more stable international position. Much more than Spain, for obvious reason, much more than France, much more than UK. Now, for the first time after the war, this is probably in danger. Is it really in danger? We will see, because also in Italy, not only in US, we have In US they call it the deep state, you know, the institution, the foreign ministry, the defense ministry, the intelligence. So to change an international position of a relevant country is not an easy task. It is not someone that goes there and says, okay, as Salvini said in Moscow, I feel at home in Moscow and not in Brussels. Yes, you can say this, but it is not easy to change the path of a so big country as Italy is. But it is a risk. One belt, one road. My personal opinion is that we need a micro.
No, you're okay with this one.
Oh, no, I have a micro. That it is, in any case, an opportunity. But we have two things. One is that we have to deal with this opportunity together in our alliances, as Europeans, first of all, as transatlantic alliance, secondly. My second point, I told it in my introduction, I will repeat it more openly, is I was recently in Delhi in a conference, and a very well-known American general, former general, asked me and another Indian former leader publicly to 200 people, so it's not a secret, where do you stand in the new Cold War between US and China? Well, my answer was, you can imagine, the European answer, multilateral, and we will try to be broker of dialogue and peace, and it's European, but it is correct. Okay, but the problem is very serious, because as I was saying, if the relation between US and Europe is only transactional, what do you put in the table for tariffs, for NATO, and it is not based on values, you will have, in a few years, several European countries that if they have, not Italy, well, perhaps this government for other reasons, but not Italy for substantial reasons, but other European countries, if they have to decide between US and China only on the basis of economic interest, they will decide China. Because Chinese investments and Chinese interests in three or four European countries already now are stronger than the Americans. So do we have a community of values? Freedom, free trade, environment. If we don't have any of this stuff, and we have only to choose on the basis of our interest, this is very dangerous. So the position of the Italian government, I hope, will not bring a change in our historical position. We need to be friends and allies, even if we are not no more in the same EU. Obviously, we need to be friends and allies with UK. But there is a question mark in our future, which is the Atlantic Alliance something still strategic for freedom, environment, peace, and so on and so forth, or is it only a matter of negotiation and transaction? If it is the second, well, the Chinese role will be very relevant in the next 10 years. I assure you.
Let me go upstairs and ask questions. Right, maybe the easiest one is next to you.
Hello, I'm Luca. I'm a student here at LSE. My question is that I think that we need a leader to carry the European project. Macron tried to do this when he was elected, but obviously with internal reasons he cannot assume this role anymore. So do you think that we need a leader, and if yes, who could he be? Or she?
Okay, Okay, then somebody just here in a dark shirt.
Thank you. I wonder if, in your opinion...
Just tell us who you are, please.
Sorry, Meenal Joshi, UK civil servant. I wonder if, in your view, you think there are any lessons learnt for the EU as coming out of the Brexit process. How can the EU ensure they can prevent the exit of any other future member state?
Okay, and right at the back, the grey shirt, grey top.
Hello, my name is Sagal. I'm an LSE student. With racism a lot in Italian news, with Salvini's hardline approach to immigration, and with the first black minister suing the Italian government for racism, I was wondering, like, how do you think racism should be tackled in Italian society, and like, what is the best way to approach the African migrants coming from Libya? Do you think we should? Do you think you should try to integrate them into society, or try to send them back to where they came from?
Question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Well, difficult to answer to the first question. Do we need a European leader? The traditional answer in the traditional. No, don't joke. The traditional answer in Europe is no. We try to choose for European top jobs ladies or gentlemen with not from fundamental countries, not always from fundamental countries, etc. Personally, I am convinced that in the next round of institutional changement in Europe, I appreciate what the previous one have done, for sure. Juncker was a very good president of the Commission from my point of view. But we need perhaps to change this idea and to have stronger personalities. Emmanuel Macron is a strong personality, but he is the French president, so it's difficult to... I don't think he wants to to leave office to become a European leader. He is a European leader, obviously. But to think to something... I don't know what... you all understand what we are talking about. There are former very relevant leaders in Europe that could have a role, play a role, institutional role, and this would help Europe if we agree on the fact that the problem Europe has is not how will we form the next pluriannual budget, but the problem Europe has is political role and political ambition. We need stronger political leaders. Do we have lessons from Brexit? Yes, first of all, Brexit was a very good, Latin says caveat, very good warning to Eurosceptics all over Europe. I would say in Italy, it is interesting how Brexit evolved, and even the new Italian government, both together, created a sort of comeback of pro-Europe sentiment in the public opinion. You know that EU makes frequently, with the same method, an analysis made by what is called Eurobarometer, testing the attitude of the different citizenship in different member states towards the Union. And it is interesting that in last autumn in Italy, we had the highest level of pro-EU sentiment since 8 years, which is connected partly to Brexit. So, do you want to enter in the problems that you are seeing in Britain, and partially to Salvini. Salvini became a strong promoter of pro-European sentiment in, not in all our citizenship, because he has his personal supporters, and I obviously respect them, but in a majority of the Italian public. And finally, racism, migration, Libya. I am worried of what is happening in my country because I think we are dangerously losing an opportunity. What opportunity are we losing? We are losing the opportunity of, without having no emergency now, because flows were very much reduced by my government, not by the new one. We don't have an emergency. So this should be the right time to work for our goals. Our goals are, one, to have humanitarian corridors for refugees, two, to transform migration, economic migration from irregular, managed by criminals, dangerous for the migrants, to something regular, safe for migrants, and if possible, also matching the needs of our economy. Is this possible? Not only possible, it is necessary. We need economic migration. When I say that there is no common policy in Europe, you know what is the European policy towards economic migration? The European policy towards economic migration is economic migration doesn't exist. Okay. Migration is only something having to do with refugees and asylum right and Dublin agreement. Economic migrants doesn't exist. Okay. Where do they live? We live in Italy, and we know that we are facing Africa, and we know that for the next 20 years, if the African development will go on for the best, we will have, in any case, economic migration coming from Africa towards Europe, crossing the Mediterranean. We will have it. The choice is, will it be a dangerous and criminal business, or will it be something regular, organized, and useful for our economies? So we are losing these opportunities, and we are doing it in a very dangerous way. Why? Because the government, with the recent law, stopped the processes of integration of irregular migrants living already in Italy. This means that we will have dozens of thousands of young people staying in Italy. They are not sending them back in their country of origin because it is not feasible. And even Salvini recognized, he had promised this in his electoral campaign, I will send them back in 2 weeks. Then after 2 weeks, he said bluntly and openly, I understood that it was I would need 8 years to send them back. So it was a joke, but not a joke. So they are not sending them back, but they are saying, telling them there is no integration process possible. This is very dangerous for my country, because Italy, in the last 10 years, had a little bit for good luck, a little bit for efficiency, but also for the capacity of cohesion and integration of our society, no serious process of radicalization, not so huge process of radicalization in our migration field. Will this continue if you send them a message of exclusion and of hate, as the government is sending? I hope so. But frankly speaking, I am very worried of the consequences, not only for integration, but also for our future of this kind of decision.
So we're playing with fire?
A little bit, yes.
Okay, I think we have time. I'm sorry, but I know many questions, but we only have time for two more because we must be out very promptly from the room. So who's going to talk? Gentleman in the tan-colored shirt, and I'll take one from the lower end, a lady with the, what I call it, pink.
So thank you. I'm Alex. I'm a student here in London. My question was about your speech. I mean, was very interesting, but I think that I saw a contradiction between what you said about functionalism, which is very important, about the Eurozone, about Schengen, and on the other hand, you said that we need more integration, we need more so-called European federalism, so we need the United States of Europe. How is it possible to combine these two elements together, especially in a time which is in which standard parties are facing problems of consensus, and I'm not so optimistic as you are, unfortunately. And let's see what's going to happen in the next election. So my question is how to combine these two elements, functionalism and federalism.
You must be a political scientist. Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Aurora, and I'm an LSE student as well. My question is in regard to the future of Europe and why Italians living outside of the European Union do not have the right to vote in EU elections.
That's probably a very simple answer.
The last question, you know the answer, but the issue could be an issue to deal with in the future, for sure. The problem of federalism and functionalism could bring us very far, but my point is that the functionalist approach, you know what it is, step by step, Europe began with an idea. It was the federalist idea, and then it was the idea to begin with a community of defense. This idea was killed, in fact, by France, because France was not le général de Gaulle was not in favor of sharing with the other five European states, founding European states, so Italy, Germany, and the three Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg, the nuclear power, and so the European process stopped for a couple of years, and then it was relaunched on something completely different, and it was coal and steel. And this was the beginning of the process. So we are not dealing with the political, military, geopolitical dimension. We are beginning with economy. As it functioned, yes, we built a fantastic single market. We have Erasmus, we have education, we have a lot of wonderful things in Europe. We have the welfare state. We are 7% of the world population, and we have 52% of social spending in EU.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Very good thing. Ask to the American workers. One-third of the American workers are paid less than $12 per hour, and they have practically no health insurance. One-third, 43 million people. So we always criticize our public services, the hospitals, the schools, the railways, okay. And they are different from country to country. But in general, this is a European uniqueness that we were able to build in these decades. Yes, okay, perfect. But my point is, is this functionalist approach that reached its zenith in the single currency sufficient in bad weather times when the geopolitical situation is so complicated, when the American administration has this kind of ideas, when the very, even the very concept of liberal democracies is challenged, and not only challenged from the outside, from Russia, China, or Turkey, or whatever, but it is challenged from inside. We have a couple of European member states that have a strange idea of liberal democracy. So in these hard times, are we continuing with a functionalist approach, only increasing our what we reached on the single market, on our trade relations, and so on and so forth? My answer is no. We should take, as also Emmanuel Macron said in his paper yesterday or 2 days ago, we have to take the initiative to go beyond. Will we be able to go beyond with all the club at the same level of integration? Perhaps no. But we have not to be scared of this, because we already have different level of integration, as I said. Not all the European member states have the single currency, not all the European member states have the Schengen treaties, and these are two very relevant things. Do you think that we could have a common web tax at 27 in EU? Go and ask to the Irish government or to the Luxembourg government if they can accept a web tax. And I respect their opinion, obviously. It is impossible for them to accept a web tax. But if Italy, Germany, Spain, France, the Netherlands, and other 10 or 12 other countries in Europe decide for a web tax, I assure you that this web tax, you can agree or not, I'm just making an example, will work, even if there are 3 or 4 countries not agreeing with this process. Okay, so this is what we have to look for. We have to be politically ambitious, leaving the door open for all the 27 member states, and maybe also for the 28th. Who knows?
Serbia.
No, UK. UK, UK. But also deciding to go beyond with our ambition. If we are in a stalemate, we will be irrelevant in the future, very complicated future of the world today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Right. Thank you very much, everybody. I'm sorry we've had to cut short the questions, but we do need to vacate the room as quickly as possible. You've already given your vote of thanks to Paolo Gentiloni. It only remains for me to say grazie mille.
Grazie.